Thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings from Faith Radio. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm trusting in what you say. Today is the day. Good morning. It is Wednesday morning, the 27th of June. The sun is rising all over our country, and everywhere we turn and everywhere we go, the tomb is still empty, for Jesus has risen, and that is good news indeed. We start our show that way every morning, just as a reminder that regardless of the difficulties of this world and the number of headlines that might trouble us that we wake up to, there is one truth that will always remain, and that is that we always have hope and future in the beautiful kingdom of our Savior. You're listening to Faith Radio Mornings. I'm your host, Dr. Peter Kapsner, joined as always in studio by Logan Rausch, running the sound and the board. And good to see you again this morning, Logan.
Happy to be here, Peter.
And there is show producer and the person in the newsroom, Paul Perreault, who you will hear chime in from time to time when it is relevant. And Rachel Sutton also is part of the show. They book the great guests that we have on each morning to sort of sort through these headlines, to inform us, to encourage us, to think about these things from our eternal point of view that we have as Christians. And Logan, we woke up this morning and realized, you know, there's really not that much to talk about this morning, right?
It must be the most boring day. There's just nothing in the news, nothing political. I turned on the news last night,
yeah,
and I saw both Anderson Cooper and Sean Hannity just sitting in hammocks.
There was nothing to talk about. I mean,
nothing to
there's
talk
no
about.
Travel bans that are Mm-mm. going on. There's not new federal decisions being made in California to reunite
nope.
families. I don't see anything.
And there's no new elected member of Congress who is a socialist and under the age of 30. It's just nothing's going on.
Yeah, what'd you think about that in New York? There's the one, she's 28 years old, mm-hmm. and in a huge upset, she won the primary in the Democratic side of things. She's going to be the youngest member of Congress because New York tends to vote much more Democratic, and she beat the city, and I think it's Crowley was his name,
mm-hmm.
and he was actually in line to be Speaker at this point to replace Pelosi, and it was a huge upset. 28 years old, socialist in her views, as a 22-year-old guy, how did you respond to this?
Well, I'm just looking ahead to the midterms and to future elections, and we hear all about the fact that, well, it seems like Trump's base is getting stronger and stronger, but then I see something like this that is absolutely the representation of everything young people want and more left-leaning people want, and it really puts me in a more confused place about what's going to be in the future, but this is absolutely the representation of kind of the perfectly of what the young generation wants. Even if that's not necessarily what all of the young generation wants, it is what the stereotypical young generation wants. I mean, she represents all the things they care about, you know, higher education, gun control, the ending of private prisons. She kind of had this checklist of, okay, how do I get people my age on board? And I mean, it worked.
Yeah, the platforms. And I mean, it feels like we just got done with some sort of campaign season. And now this is where we're in again. And it's fascinating because the Trump demographic tends to skew towards my age category and older. And then you have sort of the rise of socialism among the younger generation. The tension doesn't seem like it's going to have end anytime soon.
I really have no idea at this point, Peter.
Yeah.
I mean, the more and more I try to dig into this, the more and more I'm confused, and we'll just kind of see how it all lays out.
Well, maybe you and I can find some common ground between us as a model for this. Do you like coffee, Logan?
I am a coffee fan.
Well, let's start there. We've got the common ground of coffee. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Faith Radio Mornings. We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Jeremy Dice. He's a lawyer to help us talk through some of the travel ban situation, understanding the mechanics of the Supreme Court. Looking forward to the conversation there. Stay with us. It's about 9 minutes past the hour, and we are joined on the line now by an ongoing contributor to Faith Radio Mornings. It's Jeremy Dice, who is the Deputy General Counsel for First Liberty. Really glad to have Jeremy on this morning, as there's so many legal implications for decisions that are going on in our country. Good morning, Jeremy.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so Logan and I were just talking about, in all these generational divides, that maybe one thing that can bring us together in these mornings is coffee. Are you a coffee guy?
You know what? I'm a tea guy, I'm afraid. But, you know, it's so good. It's still a warm cup of something in the morning.
Yeah, but tea, but it just speaks already to your sophistication, your complexity. I mean, tea is far more sophisticated than this, you know, this coffee deal.
Peter, we're going to have to come up with a new unifying factor now. Coffee's already breaking down here.
It really is. So Jeremy, is tea a choice in the morning at this point?
Right now, it's something from Solstice Tea Traders called Tropicana. It's kind of a citrus black tea that it's really, really good.
Oh, wow. Yeah, the credibility level just went way up in this situation. With just dealing with legal complexity, if you can handle the complexity of tea, I have great confidence in the conversation here. So I don't know if you saw, I woke up this morning. I don't really know what happened in the case in California. It sounds like there was a ruling maybe late yesterday that a federal judge said that families can't be separated at the border any longer, and in fact, all the separated families need to be brought back together. Again, I don't know the nuance of it, but I'm curious, Jeremy. I don't think I've ever understood how a ruling in a state can have implications all across the country. Can you just talk broadly about that idea?
I thought my first reaction to that this morning was, why was this judge up so late? I mean, it was bright and early this morning that we're getting this this ruling, apparently, and I did not know that any federal worker would work that late at night, I guess. But especially, of course, we're open late, I guess, last night doing stuff. But, yeah, look, I think what it's done is just, and I've not looked into the details of this, but if I understand things correctly, this judge has reviewed the current policy of the administration and looked at it from probably a constitutional perspective, saying, hey, this is not an appropriate action by the president, and so he's got to take corrective action here very quickly. And that's what he's doing. So it's not just saying it's in this one locale, but it is actually across the country. So we'll have to look into the details of that and see what it actually plays out to be. But it sounds like the administration is going in the right direction anyway. The judge has just said, hurry up.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting. Some of the quotes I just read this morning about it said that if this is true, if this is going to become law of the land, I mean, it could take a month or 2 months or 6 or even 9 months to even possibly enforce. The judge is given like 14 days. Are judges typically aware that whatever their legal precedent is that they're setting may not at the end of the day be feasible or enforceable? How do they handle that tension?
Good question. I don't know. You'd have to ask one of the federal judges about that. But I think judges typically want to have their rulings followed and rather quickly on things. There's an old line back in the way back in the early administrations, back in Jefferson's administration, as a matter of fact, where a famous case called Marbury versus Madison, where it was established the principle of judicial review. And Chief Justice Marshall was the primary guy that focused that attention on there. And Thomas Jefferson, who was actually his cousin and kind of a rival of his as well, didn't really get along very well. He was said to have said that Chief Justice Marshall has made his decision. Now let him enforce it. And so there's that tension between the judiciary and the executive that we have in our separation of powers form of government, where judges will say, we want you to do one thing. We want you to do it right now. But there is the power of the presidency and the executive that they have some authority to do certain things, and they have the responsibility, I should say, to see that the laws are faithfully executed. Sometimes it doesn't always happen on the timetables that the judges want, but as best as possible, everybody tries to abide by those rulings. Of course, there are appeals that could delay things. All that kind of stuff goes into it as well.
It's Jeremy Dias, the Deputy General Counsel for First Liberty. And of course, the big headlines coming out of yesterday, Jeremy, was that the Supreme Court upheld the ruling on the travel ban by a vote of 5-4. Kind of just remind us about what was at stake here and what are some of the implications of that now moving forward.
This was, I think, the third iteration of the so-called travel ban or the immigration policy that prevented certain travelers immigrating to the United States from certain countries. And specifically, those countries were ones that the president identified as posing a national threat or national security threat to our country. And they were said to largely have been from Muslim-dominated countries, whatever that exactly means. I'm not entirely sure. But evidently, that was the controversy going on. And what the Supreme Court did was to basically say, look, there is a certain power within the presidency, a certain authority that he has to be able to make decisions based upon immigration, based upon what is in the national security interest of the United States. And so the court simply applied current law and said, and the Constitution for that matter, and said that the president has that inherent authority in his executive agencies. His executive authority has that right. And so this travel ban was constitutional. There's going to be a lot of fallout about that. A lot of people are going to disagree. And even the Chief Justice who wrote the opinion, majority opinion, said, look, we're not commenting on the merits of this policy, so to speak. We're just saying that he's got the right to be able to make that decision.
Well, and it's interesting because I think there is some momentum to suggest that some of the president's Twitter comments on the campaign trail could or should be weighed into this as evidence that it's more of a racist policy versus a national security one. And it sounds like some of the judges in the dissent reference some of that. Can judges look backwards and see what comments were from the president like that and have them applied to the case?
There sure seems to be a trend in that direction. Justice Sotomayor, in her dissenting opinion, made much of religious liberty as a reason for not upholding this travel ban, and said instead that his tweets, his comments on the campaign trail, et cetera, were the reasons why this was an actual discriminatory policy. So they wanted to look behind the actual four letters or four corners of the document that enforced this measure. That concerns me to some degree, because if we're looking outside the actual political or the actual legal actions taken by the president, I think we're setting a precedent that it's not going to be beneficial. It's going to be hard for people to be engaged in political dialogue if every time they speak they open themselves up to being held, especially when they were not even an elected official yet, when they're making those comments, that those could be used against them later on in the court of law. It's already been determined by one judge somewhere else that President Trump's Twitter account, his personal Twitter account that he brought into the administration, I expect that he will take with him when he leaves the presidency, that is now a government mouthpiece, and he can't ban people on Twitter that are harassing him.
It's just fascinating to watch. I mean, it's difficult enough, right, to interpret the law, much less interpret somebody's Twitter account day in and day out. And so I'm curious how big of a deal it really was that that Trump was able to bring somebody into the Supreme Court in Gorsuch, who is far more conservative. I mean, this may have tipped the balance of this. This decision would have even come to the table, obviously, with President Clinton if she had won. But how big of a deal is it that these judges do go one way or the other, conservative or liberal?
Well, it's enormous. I mean, yesterday's decision was a 5-4 decision. That's one vote. It goes one way or the other way. And Justice Gorsuch was that vote. That's been the case on several times this term, that Justice Gorsuch has been within the majority, within the conservative majority. We were told that Judge Merrick Garland was nominated before President Trump took office. Of course, we're told that he was a moderate. And yet now we're told that he would have sided with the liberal side of the court every single time. That's interesting that a moderate position is actually a liberal position, it seems like these days. But, from our perspective, from First Liberty's perspective on religious liberty, it's been very good to have Justice Gorsuch on the bench carefully weighing these issues and siding them in favor of religious freedom more often than not.
We're talking with Jeremy Dice of First Liberty, and we'll take a short break, Jeremy. When we come back, you're working on a really interesting case around a veterans memorial and whether or not that the memorial itself can stand, and there's a lot of tension back and forth on that. So I look forward to getting into that case with you. It's Faith Radio Mornings. I'm Dr. Peter Kapsner. We'll be back in just a moment. Just about 21 minutes past the hour. This is Faith Radio Mornings, and we have Jeremy Dice from First Liberty Institute on the line with us. And Jeremy, you work on some really interesting cases. I loved going to your website and seeing sort of your 1.5-minute snippets that give us a little sense of each of these cases you're working on. And one that you're looking at right now has to do with whether this historic World War I memorial needs to be removed. It's in the shape of a cross. Kind of walk us through this case. What's happening here?
Back in 1919, 10 Gold Star mothers, women who had lost their children in World War I, got together and planned a memorial for their sons. 49 men from Prince George's County, Maryland, who fell in the Great War. And they planned this memorial, and later the American Legion, which was formed out of World War I, of course, they got back from in the States, and their comrades, they finished the job and erected this monument called the Bladensburg World War I Veterans Memorial in Bladensburg, Maryland, right outside of Washington, D.C. And it's a monument to the 49 men who died from Prince George's County, Maryland. It stood there from 1925 until present. It was initially on American Legion property, but when the road around it, and the road, by the way, is the National Defense Highway, which is also a World War I memorial, that road had to be expanded in the 1960s. And the state ended up taking the property through eminent domain to be able to expand the highway, but there's no way they were going to tear down that monument at that time. There was such an outcry against that idea. And so they left it standing in the middle of the road in the median right there. And if you go there today, you'll still see it. And so this memorial, which is surrounded by memorials to the Battle of Bladensburg of War of 1812, World War II, Vietnam, Korea, all these memorials are within a chip shot of this memorial. It stood there since 1925 until recently when an atheist or a humanist had decided that that was offensive and couldn't bear to even look at it when he drove by it. And so he sued the state of Maryland and our clients, the American Legion, intervened in this lawsuit saying, hey, this is what the Gold Star mothers chose to put up here to remember their kids. It's perfectly constitutional. The mere fact that it appears on government property does not negate the fact that it is a war memorial that happens to reflect the gravestones of the men in World War I. So many of them in Europe were buried under a simple wooden cross or a Celtic cross, as this design is. We even have a letter of one of the mothers, Martha Redman, Martin Redman's mother, or William Redman's mother. She said that I can't visit my son's grave in Europe, but I very much view this memorial as my son's gravestone. And so we have now petitioned the Supreme Court of the United States because a Fourth Circuit judge or several Fourth Circuit judges determined that it is, in fact, unconstitutional to have that memorial there. And the only solution for this, so the Fourth Circuit says, is to either tear down the memorial or to simply remove its horizontal arms and turn it into an obelisk instead. We cannot stomach that. And so we've asked the Supreme Court of the United States on behalf of our clients, the American Legion, to review this case and to preserve this memorial for another 100 years.
I'm just amazed at somebody being fussed by this sort of idea of a memorial. My family and I were standing on the beaches of Normandy at Omaha Beach a couple of months ago and just so moved by this 10,000 tombs, some of them crosses, some of them stars of David. Wasn't really even thinking about the religious significance of it. It was the sacrifice. It was the honor. Is there really a legal precedent for being sort of psychologically disturbed by a memorial? Does the atheist have a case in this situation?
No, we're told under the First Amendment that if you see a billboard that is obscene, that has pornographic images or whatever, you fuddy-duddies need to just turn your head and close your eyes. That's protected First Amendment speech up there. But apparently a grown man can't drive by a memorial to 49 men who died preserving our freedom. That is atrocious to me. And so that's why we filed this petition for appeal before the Supreme Court of the United States. I got to tell you, during oral argument at the Fourth Circuit, this was just remarkable. During oral argument, we're making the case, and one of the judges breaks in and says, well, it seems to me that the problem here is that the monument has this horizontal arm. It's the shape of this monument. Why don't we just resolve this by removing the horizontal arms? And our attorney that was arguing the case was rather dumbfounded, but managed to squeak out, Your Honor, you'd like us to deface a veterans memorial? Is that the solution that you're presenting here, that we would deface this veterans memorial? This is the thinking of judges on the Fourth Circuit right now that think that somehow just because it has this shape that is reminiscent of the gravestones of the fields of Europe that you saw, and that men like Teddy Roosevelt's own son were buried underneath, that somehow that is an establishment of religion in violation of the Constitution of the United States. Nothing could be further from the truth. The reality is that this is a perfectly acceptable monument that the women and men returning back from World War I erected because they knew we forget what we do not see. And so they wanted to make sure their sons were remembered well into the future. Here we are 92 or so years later, still remembering the sacrifice of William Redman and Henry Hulbert and so many others that are on that monument who died preserving our freedom.
Jeremy, we have just less than a minute left here. Are you seeing more and more of these kind of cases around censorship of memorials and just the way that we can think about things as a country?
Sadly, yes. I mean, folks can go to firstliberty.org to learn a lot more about these. And you referenced the podcast, the First Liberty Briefing, that talks about them as well. But, you know, it's just something that to keep our eyes on. You know, I represent a valedictorian who couldn't give his valedictory address because he wanted to say the word God in his speech. I mean, goodness sakes, how many more graduation ceremonies have to be ruined before school officials get the message that that's wrong? We represent chaplains in the United States military that are simply obeying the rules of the denomination that sends them and the army, and they're facing punishment. I could go on and on about cases that we've got going on right now, Jewish cases in New York where they're trying to zone out anybody from being able to hold a prayer meeting in their home. I mean, there's all kinds of these cases that I'd urge folks to go to firstliberty.org to learn more about.
Yeah, it's a great site, Jeremy. Jeremy, this firstliberty.org you referenced, just incredible information. We really appreciate you joining us this morning to help us through some of the complexities of these headlines of the day.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so we're 27 minutes past the hour. We'll take a break for to lighten up as well as news, and we'll come back for our second half of the first hour. You know, Logan, I love that conversation with Jeremy. We were talking off the air just when we lived in Scotland for a period of time as a family. I was really amazed in the state-run school systems that our children were a part of that they had no trouble celebrating Christmas. They had no trouble celebrating Ramadan or Rosh Hashanah, some of these different religious festivals, acknowledging the importance that the role of religion plays in people's lives.
I think that's so important, and it's really the goal that we strive to reach as America with the freedom of liberty and religion that somehow we're kind of missing. You know, we should be able to celebrate each other as human beings and support each other, even if we don't want to engage in something that we deem as not right.
Well said, Logan. Let's take a break for news. And when we come back for the second half of the hour, we'll talk about teenagers and depression, another one of the things that's top of the mind these days in our country. Stay with us. We'll be back in a few. Speaker and author Lisa Bevere is speaking to us this morning about the idea of hope, something we care deeply about on this show.
We need to understand we're in a day and an age where we need to sharpen one another. And that's the whole idea of fierce faith. This is a battleground. This is not a playground. We are not here to escape. We are here to be light. We are here to bring hope. We are here to be messengers and ambassadors of God's kingdom, where we can say, repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand, and people can turn and find life.
If you want to find that entire segment, head to myfaithradio.com and search for Hope or Call to Bring Hope. Great stuff. You'll want to listen to that. We'll take a break and be back and talk about depression with our teenagers.
There are staggering consequences when traditional biblical values are stripped away. This is Jim Garlow, and core values matter. They matter a lot. I'm not sure as a society that we understand the importance of this issue. Ideas have consequences. Good ideas bring great results. Bad ideas can have catastrophic impact. What if you made yourself the source of all truth? Many people, more than I want to think about at times, see themselves in that light. But human beings need something else, something more, or catastrophe awaits. Trust yourself? Really? If so, you underestimate how wicked the human heart can be. You and I need something else as the core of our life, something that has stood the test through all eternity. We need biblical, scriptural values, eternal values. Biblical values are the core of our lives, our families, our churches, and our nation. We'll do our part, keeping you informed at jimgarlow.com.
Thirty-seven minutes past the hour, and Logan, one of the things that I've noticed over the last maybe 20 years of teaching, and then specifically over the last 5 or 6 years, has been there's been a significant rise of anxiety and depression among our 18 to 22-year-olds. So I had the opportunity a few mornings ago to talk with Dr. Greg Jantz about what is happening with depression and how we can help our young people. So let's listen to that now. Well, good morning. You are listening to Faith Radio Mornings. I am your interim host, Dr. Peter Kapsner, and thrilled to be joined this morning by Dr. Greg Jantz, who is a nationally certified psychologist, a licensed mental health counselor, a certified chemical dependency counselor. And Dr. Jantz, you've been on with Dr. Phil, 700 Club, and written a series of books. And back, you've been in this field for quite a while, haven't you?
Oh, my goodness. I guess we're going on 31 years.
31 years. So I'd be curious your thoughts. I know for me in the classroom over the last 10 years, I've seen a pretty considerable spike in anxiety and depression among young people. I don't know if that's because of the rise of social media and smartphones and all of that. What have you seen over some of this time related to that as well?
Well, we have seen we live in a very anxious and anxiety-prone culture. And, you know, anxiety means it's hit us physically. So we have physical symptoms and from the anxiety, and our sleep is disrupted. And we see the same thing with depression. Even the World Health Organization tells us that depression is going to be the number one. They're calling it a disease in the world. So depression higher than cancer, heart disease, depression. It's just amazing to think about that. But yet we are seeing it. We're seeing more depressed teenagers. We're seeing depression at really, truly all ages. So this is a probably fair to say an epidemic issue. And people are searching for answers.
Yeah, I don't think that's an exaggeration at all. It sort of seems to be everywhere we turn. And you talk about depression can be marked by three different kinds of characteristics. They work together, but sort of some of the things that you look for are the frequency of the depressive episodes, the severity, and the duration of them. Can you kind of help us understand these elements and kind of how they all go together?
Absolutely. You know, Peter, all of us have periods of times in our life that maybe are especially challenged and we do feel depressed. Maybe an example of that could be a loss, maybe a loss of a loved one, a loss of a job, but there's been loss. And so a depression could be a normal response. Now, what we're talking about, though, here with frequency and how often does this happen, how long the duration, so, and then how deep is it? Well, when we don't pull out of those things, when 6 months has passed and we're getting worse, not better, I think it's really important to look at that. So there's, what we'll say is there's a type of depression that can be normal response, but we move through it. We're resilient. But we're not seeing that. We know we're in trouble. If things are not changing, we're experiencing more symptoms. And, you know, we've isolated more and more. We've disconnected with real life and real people. Maybe we've gone online, but we've disconnected with relationships. So depression affects what we know is the whole person.
It does. And do you find it's similar to or different than maybe, say, alcoholism, where so often there needs to be people from the outside that can look in and say, look, you're really struggling with alcoholism. You really need help. Do people that are really in more than just kind of a weekly sort of mood change, but in the severity of depression, do they recognize it themselves or do they need people outside to help them see it?
I think we recognize that something severely is wrong. We may not understand what it is. And this is where so often we'll go to our family physician and we start to describe some symptoms. And our physician may say, well, it sounds like you're depressed and you may be prescribed a medication, which can be a good place to start. We need to be able to function. But one of the things that we've been doing now over 30 years is looking at this whole person approach. We've got to look at, what's the going on in our body chemistry, what's going on in our nutrition, what's going on spiritually, what's going on in relationships, perhaps in our past as well. So we can really look at this depression. I like to see it as one big 1,000-piece puzzle.
Mm.
And there's so many different pieces, and we're going to take the time to put in all the right pieces.
I really appreciate the idea of the holistic approach because I think at least I would be prone to there's got to be sort of one magic solution. If I just have a conversation with a counselor, if I just take this medicine, if I have this kind of herbal supplement or whatever it might happen to be. So I think it'd be helpful for our listeners to talk about some of these different dimensions that you referenced there. And let's start with sort of the use of medication. What role this has, because it's a question I get often from my young people is saying, should I start this medication train? Should I even get on this? What are sort of the upsides and downsides of using medication as a part of this process?
Well, we, and I'm from the Center of Place of Hope, so we treat people from all over the country who come in with some pretty significant depression. And we have a medical team who assesses. And so often we're working with people who they could be on four or five different medications, and they're saying, you know, something's not working. And they're looking for different options. So I think we like to see the use of medication as it's a bridge. Mm. It's probably to get you over the troubled waters, but let's not just do that. Let's look at other things as well. And so I believe that it's one piece. We don't ever want to just see depression as there's a magic pill. I think we'll be disappointed. But if we're willing to look at all the different pieces, I believe that's where we're going to have more success.
So it sounds like what I'm hearing you say is that medication can be a helpful starting point to sort of then just create some space then and create the possibility, kind of take a breath so that we can start doing the holistic work relationally and psychologically and spiritually, get after some of those things that's probably giving rise to the depressive state to begin with.
Yes, absolutely. So, well said.
Yeah. So from there, and we've got a minute before we'll just head to break. Where's sort of a starting point that once people get over the hump, where do you go with them next? Do you find the spiritual conversation, some family of origin, or is it just dependent upon the person?
Well, you know, sometimes there could be some significant trauma and we need to address trauma. There could be an abusive relationship that could be contributing to this. There could be some what we'll call complicated grief, where there's been significant loss and you're just not, you know, pulling through it and recovering. So everybody is wonderfully unique, but we know that we've got to cover all the bases. And, you know, there's times where you're depressed, you feel like, man, I'm in a spiritual desert and I don't feel loved. I don't feel God loves me. I don't feel meaning or purpose in my life. And so we've got to look at, well, what are those core issues that have to be addressed?
We're speaking with Dr. Greg Jantz this morning just about the epidemic of depression and how significant it's become among not just young people, but I think all of us in general on some levels are kind of in this place of depression and anxiety. We'll take a short break, and when we return, we'll keep digging into how we can find some hope to get out of this situation. Be right back. Welcome back. We are here with Dr. Greg Jantz, and we are addressing, again, what has just become so pervasive is this sort of depressive anxiety state, and Dr. Jantz is an expert in this field. And there's a quote that I saw as part of the interview here that you passed along that talks about the importance of future. So I'll just read this, and I would love for you to comment on this. It says, "Without joy, there is no hope. Without hope, there is not optimism. Without optimism, there is no future. And people without a sense of future become depressed." Can you just say more about this kind of process and how the joy and future and hope are all tied together in this?
We know that we need to have a sense of hope about our future. If we feel apathetic, if we don't see any hope and we stay in a place of despair, this is where we can feel even suicidal. We start to think, well, it'd be better off if I even wasn't even around. So this is why it's so important that ultimately we've got to look to resolving things so we can have optimism.
And you talk about hope being the bedrock to recovery. How does that? I mean, can you just drum that up, or how do you help somebody have hope? Is it to realize ideas and dreams in their life, or are we talking about something even deeper and maybe more spiritual? How do you approach it, just bringing hope?
You know, I think there is a hope that is a deep sense of inner peace, and that may be absent with depression. There's a hope that comes from a realization that God loves me. I am lovable. There's a hope that comes from knowing that I have an eternal future. And so there's hope on different levels, but there's a security about our eternal hope that I think is an important one to come to.
And Dr. Jantz, for parents maybe of kids, that if they start seeing some, what are some maybe very early signs you would suggest looking for so that there can be some intervention before they go to these places of hopelessness and depression and maybe a bit of despair? Are there some really subtle warning signs that you would encourage parents to look for?
You know, for our teens and our 13, 17-year-old kids, if we begin to see, obviously there could be some academic struggles or failure. If we see a kid isolate, disconnect from all peer groups, you know, they're isolating, they're escaping through social media, escaping through gaming, this isolation and disconnect. We may also find that they are even using language that seems maybe self-destructive. So kids go through seasons. And so sometimes we get alarmed and go, what's wrong with my kid? Well, sometimes there's some normal seasons they go through. But when they don't move through this, you know, and 3 months have passed and you're seeing just a sense of total disconnect. We know that they may find that they're escaping through experimentation through drugs or alcohol. And a kid's really got two questions. A kid wants to know, who am I? And then number two is, where do I fit in? Mm. Where do I fit in? And so if you're saying, man, who am I and where do I fit in? And if a kid feels like, man, I don't fit in anywhere, that could be a danger sign.
Mm. Now, we're speaking with Dr. Greg Jantz just again around depression and anxiety. I'm curious, too, that do you see a seasonality to this just in terms of, you know, fall, winter, summer, spring? I know there's something that is called seasonal affective disorder. Are there times of the year where we might be more susceptible to entering into depression?
You know, for some, they really do notice it with the change of the seasons. And even there's a summer depression, as odd as that may sound.
That does sound odd.
I feel like, I'm missing out.
I know, right?
And and then there's, of course, the transition into fall and winter. And some folks, the seasonal affective disorder, they may seem to be maybe more sensitive to that. And there's a sense of dread as the fall and winter comes. There's just a sense of this, it's a heaviness. It's like, I don't know if I can make it through another winter.
Mm. And you wrote a book called Overcoming Anxiety, Worry, and Fear. So whatever our sort of road is to this, whether it's seasonal disorder or whether it is sort of a trauma, a significant one, or a buildup of many traumas, or whatever it happens to be, in your book, you talk about that even pain, as hard as it is, can have a purpose in God's plan. And how does that? How do we interact with that idea? Because I think most of us want to run from pain as opposed to seeing its purpose sometimes.
Yes. You know, here's the thing. We don't want to avoid anything, but we don't want to stay stuck in the processing of everything. So sometimes we can get real cyclic. We're just and we get stuck in a process, and we stay hurt, or we stay in that injury. A person may be prone to depression if it's a situation where they are so easily hurt, so easily take on offenses. They're going to be prone towards depression, and so we've got to move beyond a hyper sense of sensitivity. Because that'll keep us stuck in depression.
Mm. Dr. Jantz, great stuff this morning. Can you give us some resources, both things that you've written and also just the website you referenced again, where people can go to keep interacting with this topic with you?
You know, one of the things that could be helpful is a free depression survey that we have. And I would encourage, just take the survey. It's a free confidential survey. And go to A Place of Hope. A Place of Hope.com.
What a great name for a site. I think a lot of us are looking for it. I think there's so many headlines and so many difficulties that leave us feeling that hopelessness. I appreciate your work and just interceding in this, and would love to have you on again sometime, Dr. Janse. Thank you for your time. That was Dr. Greg Janse. Just super helpful to think about issues of depression among our teenagers. We'll take a short break, wrap up our hour, and get set up for hour two. Stay with us. You know, Logan, we started out the show this morning recognizing that there was a ton of headlines happening today, and one of them related to the Democratic senator out of New York who is 28 years old and looks like she's going to win the election and be the youngest person in Congress that has ever been elected. And so we are noticing differences between you and me generationally. We thought we had some common ground with coffee between us, only to find Jeremy Dice say that really he drinks tea. And so now I'm stuck again. You brought up the idea that maybe sequels could hold us together of movies, the best possible sequel. I suggested Empire Strikes Back. You came up with Ace Ventura, Pet Detective. We're still struggling here, Logan. We're still struggling.
I think we can all unify around the best movie sequel of all time is Empire Strikes Back. Any contestant to that, Paul?
I don't know. I like it. I'll go with it. I'll just go with it, okay?
All right.
Because I remember, like, and maybe it was just the magic of back then, you could only see the movie in the theater, and I remember standing in line for, like, hours because the 12 o'clock showing was sold out. We'd have to wait to the 2:30. Couldn't wait to get in. And then there was this magical invention called the VCR. I know you don't maybe know what that is.
Oh,
but
no.
You, really?
I had a VHS collection that was taller than I'll ever be.
Well, and that's the nice part these days, right? You don't have to dedicate an entire room to a library of former Disney movies. I remember that great moment where we could sell them on eBay for like a quarter each. So these are the generational divides, but the important piece is what's so fun about being on the show with you each morning is that we can laugh about these things, and there's so much actually more that binds us together on this journey. And so I appreciate the model of that I can have with you.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have so much that is different about us, but we both love so many of the same things. I mean, like we said sometime yesterday, there is more that keeps us together than does separate us, especially in this country. We have so much that is in common that we need to stop focusing on what is so different and look at how we represent each other as brothers and sisters in Christ.
I love that, Logan. We'll take a break for Top of the Hour and be back with Bill English the first half of next hour. Stay with us.
Again, thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings. You can hear other podcasts at myfaithradio.com. Plus, remember, we are listener-supported, so your support makes Faith Radio Mornings and the other programs from Faith Radio possible. Make your gift at myfaithradio.com.